seems like that you in this deadly struggle under miserable conditions, and the whole universe is united against you. In August of 1944, as American GIs swept into Paris, a gruesome winter campaign seemed unimaginable. Gene Derrickson of the 28th Division wrote home to his wife, "The roads we journey now, and we are traveling fast on foot, are littered with Nazi equipment burned and destroyed. Along the road, I've eaten blackberries, carrots, apples, and pears. Then a good night's sleep. Soft sleeping on flax." Four months before the Battle of the Bulge, Derrickson and his division led the parade through Paris, past the reviewing stand where the brass stood. And where the brass stood was clear. Hitler was now on the run. Ike had a standing bet. The war would be done by Christmas.
To be present when this triumphal march took place was as though it was a reward for the victories won and the enemy defeated. People were hugging and kissing and giving people things. It was a kind of a delirium.
Troops came down the Champs-Élysées and progressed to the Place de Concorde, and we alternated playing marches with the French band. There was just wall-to-wall people everywhere, and cheering and grabbing the soldiers and hugging them.
Boy, that was beautiful.
After five hard years of war, the Allies had won back Casablanca and Tripoli, Naples and Rome, Cherbourg and St. Lo. The list of victories seemed to grow each day.
It looked to us as though we had certainly turned the corner. We were now so triumphant, and this our show of strength and of moral position and moral strength was so astonishing, was so inspiring. It was very hard to be objective about it.
One afternoon, I was sitting having a glass of wine and watching our traffic stream by. Just a steady procession of tanks, trucks, tank carriers, unbroken for hours, loaded with troops and everything under the sun. It was a feeling that, by golly, any nation that can produce all of these things, ship them all the way across the Atlantic, all the way across France and chase the German. This was a country that could do anything. We had a grand ride right across France. We were not held up anywhere, and we went all the way on to the Siegfried Line. The German was running very, very hard.
Once the Gestapo was ushered out of Paris, Allied staff officers and war correspondents reclaimed the bar at the Ritz. Restaurants reopened. Fashion shows came back. Women could hope for silk stockings again. The War Department was shifting troops over to the Pacific. For the first time in years, U.S. production of tanks, ships, and ammunition was allowed to dip.
From late October through November and early December, they were building up for this attack. Their production level reached its highest in the fall and winter of 1944. So how'd they do that? I'm talking about tanks, artillery, trucks, ammunition. They were cranking it out in these underground factories that had somehow evaded our Air Force.
The German counterattack was conceived and planned by one man, the Reichsfuhrer Adolf Hitler. Hitler was, by his own lights, a man of destiny. For him, Germany's suffering was merely a test of its will. He'd seen 4 million Germans killed, wounded, or taken prisoner. No matter, he would create a new army with a fancy name, the People's Infantry, the Volksgrenadier. What it was an army of cripples and convicts, children and grandfathers, but the Führer was in a state of euphoria. His Volksgrenadier would join the very best troops he had, the Waffen-SS, in a surprise attack in the West. Everything must be set aside for this, Hitler confided. It will lead to collapse and panic among Americans.
Hitler knew that something was wrong. Back in October, September, October, he knew that he was leaking. Orders that he gave were reaching the Allies. He thought he had spies in his staff. But he did the one thing that made it impossible to do anything with it, and that is shut up. Radio silence, in effect. And when it stopped coming, it just happened to stop coming in a period when we figured, well, there isn't anything to say. These guys are losers.
We had a preconception that they were unable to launch a counterattack, and they did everything they could to make us believe that. So you could say it was a case of self-delusion on our part.
Allied planes were bombing Berlin at will. The Russians were destroying the Wehrmacht in the east. There was speculation that Hitler was already dead. In fact, he had retreated to an underground bunker, cut off from even his highest commanders, poring over maps, planning his last great attack down to the smallest detail.
The Battle of the Bulge, the base of it really was an 80-mile front running from southern Belgium down to Edelbrook in the middle of Luxembourg, the Ardennes Forest here, between my thumb and forefinger. Hitler's concept was to attack on that 80-mile front, swing north, and seize the port of Antwerp. He was going to split the British and American forces and capture those people surrounded in here.
We did hear tanks moving, trucks moving, all sorts of noises indicative of the assembly of strength. And when we reported it, we were told from Corps, I think, certainly from Division, they're playing phonograph records. They know we're a green division, and they're just trying to put the scare on you. And I'm sure they had played phonograph records of tank movement before and gotten some results. These weren't phonograph records. They were tanks. But we accepted that because of our mindset that these people can't really launch a serious attack.
A quarter of a million Germans waited at the border. On December 16th, a Saturday, clouds and fog covered the valleys. It was the weather Hitler said he needed to keep the American bombers off his back. That day, a message went out to the 5th Panzer Army. Soldiers of the West Front, your great hour has arrived.
I was a division special troops dental officer, and I was stationed about 10 miles from the front in Wiltz, Luxembourg.
And Sergeant Paul Gifford was late, and I sort of was a wise guy, and I told him he's late. He said, well, Captain, I'm sorry, but I lost my tank. And I said, boy, they're expensive as hell. You better go get that tank. He said, well, the Germans took it. I said, well, now you better go back and get that tank. I mean, you can't go losing a tank to the Germans. It's bad business. So I got the usual laughter, and I said, what happened to Colonel so-and-so? He's going to give it to you. He said, he lost his artillery piece. I said, what's happening? He said, the Germans are pushing. Division headquarters, of which I was a part, was aware that there were now an increase in the artillery, enemy artillery fire and all that. But nothing terribly dramatic except There was a hush that seemed that really and truly you could feel a hush, as though the civilians sensed what we didn't comprehend.
We were going to Edelbrook to play for the troops, and we began to see all these soldiers that they brought in there, GIs that were all banged up and wounded. So we went to inquire and see what it had planned, and there were so many wounded soldiers lying in this hospital. Well, they called off our performance because there was too many. It was the beginning of the bulge. We didn't know it at the time.
Yeah, that's right. That was the beginning.
The shells were flying all night long as we were trying to sleep. And when it came down the next morning, that was something else. He says, well, how'd you sleep? Not very good, you know.
I went to bed, and the next morning at 6 o'clock, one of my messengers came over to wake me, and he said, everything's popping loose. And I said, I told this man to go on and leave me alone. I said, and then at that time, I heard the screaming Mimis start coming in, the artillery and all types of artillery. That was December the 16th. That was a very, very rough day. And by that night, the Germans were all over us, within 10, 15 yards right in front of us. If you could see a bunch of wild cattle running wild, that's what it reminded you of. I believe they were doped. I believe that the German soldiers were doped to a certain extent, because they were acting as if, I don't care if I get killed or not. They were like wild men. That's the best I could describe it of that first night.
I thought that my division had been hit by what we'd been taught in the fancy language of military academies and books as a spoiling attack. And that it just amounted to getting our act together and we'd throw them out. I certainly never believed that we'd been hit by a force that was really going to tear us up. Never.
The men on the front line were hunkered in foxholes, cut off from each other. They had no idea they were being hit by one of the largest German artillery attacks of the war, or that they were outnumbered in some places by 10 to 1.
We lost many men that first day. An infantry company was approximately 200 men. A company was 21 men after the first day. C company could account for 59 men. And in my company, I only lost 28 men the first day. Every company commander was missing the first day except my company commander. It's really hard to believe, but it happened. Some of my better men in garrison were some of the first ones to crack under combat conditions. They were like hugging each other and just shivering from scared. Never had seen such a thing before.
Every night of the week at 8 o'clock, let discovery bring you the world. Ancient mysteries, wildlife, the frontiers of science, human achievement and culture. The best documentaries from across the...
Dwight Eisenhower and Omar Bradley, the two most powerful commanders in Europe, got word of the attack on the 16th at Versailles. But the news had little impact that first day. Ike went to a reception to toast his orderly's new bride and his own promotion to five-star general. The British commander, Field Marshal Montgomery, was briefed while on the golf course.
On the afternoon of the 16th, there was no real worry or concern.
about the severity of the attack. Those worries started on Sunday morning. And I remember General Bradley walking up into the war room that afternoon, looking at the map and said, where in the world has the son of a bitch gotten all of this stuff? He preceded that by saying, pardon my French. He was a very mild-mannered man in his speech. But yes, everyone was genuinely surprised by the force of the German attack at that point.
By Monday, refugees were streaming down the streets with their household possessions, and their faces are absolutely grim, and there's no greeting of any kind. And you know that you're looking at a classic kind of thing, refugees before the enemy. And one of the first things I did was to go up to headquarters up the hill. And there it looked as though it was a recently disturbed anthill. People were running in all directions. Soldiers were running in all, at seemingly haphazard, jumping on vehicles that were taking off. At that time, there seemed to be nobody in charge. Nobody in charge. I saw one higher officer absolutely lose his wits, and he seemed to be trying to crank a Jeep. And there haven't been cranks on cars for a long time. He was just absolutely panic-stricken. And that disturbed me a lot. That shook me up.
It was not an orderly retreat. We were just doing what we thought was best at that particular time. Primarily, we were backing up. We didn't really know where we were going, but it was primarily backing up.
Nothing was organized in the way of retreat.
Nothing was organized.
No, because we were too spread out and too confused to begin with.
Norm Plum and Clyde Burkholder made up the better part of the trombone section of the 28th Division Dance Band. Clyde was a 5'1" crooner with a voice reminiscent of Eddie Cantor, but with little talent for soldiering. He and Plum were part of the ad hoc assembly of rear guard troops now charged with engaging the Panzertruppen.
And they divided us up, the band with others, quartermaster, people from finance. A lot of them had weapons they didn't even know how to use properly.
Including the band.
Yeah, when they, in fact, I think some of the band I heard had a bazooka, or somebody had one.
You gotta be kidding. We were lucky we could load a carbine, let alone a machine gun, and everybody standing.
Well, that's all we had is carbines.
Yeah, but I was thinking that when I brought the bullets there, and everybody kept saying, what are they for?
Well, starting at noon, we went to hell in a handbasket. As soon as we got into the woods, we ran into Germans. And as we pushed forward, we ran into more and more Germans until by the time we got to the road that we were supposed to cut and go across, we were just backed up. It was a heavy firefight. It was a lot of fire. My platoon was just melting away. I went back and found the company first sergeant who said, there's an order for us to pull out, come back. And I, in the dusk, I saw a man, and I yelled at him to... I'm sure fairly obscenely, to get his act out of there, that we were leaving, and he wasn't mine, he was a German, and he shot me. And I was put in the aid station, and I remember during the night, the chaplain came to me and said, Ollie, we got to go. We're going to leave those of you who cannot walk in the aid station under the care of a medic, a soldier who's volunteered to look after you. And it dawned on me then that things had gotten serious, that you don't abandon, you don't leave your wounded, you get them out. And what he was telling me is, we can't get you out.
On either the 18th or 19th, which would have been the third or fourth day, the senior colonel called back to division headquarters and said, we have no ammunition, because they only had 48 rounds per man to begin with. And that was gone after the 3 days. He called back to the division commander and said, we have no choice but to surrender.
Encircled and under artillery and even tank fire and many Germans on either side, the remnants were surrendered. We lost 2/3 of the infantry strength of the division on that day.
More than 4,000 men of the 106th were given up. Only the American surrender at Bataan was larger. These men had been on the line 8 days, in combat for 3. Alan Jones, their general, was stunned. "I've lost a division faster than any other commander in the U.S. Army."
After we surrendered, the German corporal took me forward, and then they put me on the hood of a car. I was sitting with my legs dangling over the grill, and he had a pistol to my head. And so we went up and down some hills, and I was like a trophy on the hood of this car with this pistol on my head. And to my absolute astonishment, I was looking at droves and herds of beautifully uniformed, young, healthy-looking, well-fed, well-equipped German troops. And my heart sank. God, they did it. I mean, they surprised us. They've got stores of people that we didn't know about. Wow. And they came by, these young, good-looking kids, laughing at me as a trophy. We had been surprised and were in trouble.
This is the G.I. Jack, man alive. It starts with the bugler blowing reveille over your bed when you arrive. Jack, that's the G.I. Jack. Rootledy-toot, jump in your suit, make a salute.
I had a friend, Herb Spence, and another friend, Jack Manley. Of course, we were real thrilled that we had a pass, you know, could get out like that. We got to Paris, big city unknown to us. We hadn't been there before, you know, or anything like that. And we were looking for a good time, and we didn't have any trouble finding girls and like that. And I remember staying in a hotel, a place called Place de Clichy, and a nice little hotel there, and they plenty of supply of cognac and this sort of stuff, you know. So we would sit around and talk, and the girls would come in. And the particular girl that I had little short legs, about so long, and I think she weighed probably, well, I guess in the neighborhood of 140 pounds. And she did a pretty good job with you when you were in the action, let's say, when you were in action, in combat. But let me put it that way.
This is the G.I. Jack, man alive.
She was a country girl, and she would come in from the farm. Now, I know Spence's girlfriend was a real model. Manley didn't care.
Jack, after you revive.
We had men on leaves and passes in England. We had lots of people in Paris. So we were thinking about everything except the fact that we might have to go back to combat. I was having a party in my quarters in Mormelon, and it was a good party because we were in the middle of the champagne country there. And I went over to the headquarters where General McAuliffe informed me that he had just had a call that there had been a breakthrough in the Ardennes. He knew little more than that about it, but we were probably going to be moving out the following morning. Surprise would be to put it very, very mildly. We were flabbergasted.
By the evening of the second day of battle, the Allied commanders understood the enormity of their situation. 25 German divisions were on the attack against only 4.5 U.S. divisions. Eisenhower and Bradley reached for the only reserves they had, the 82nd Airborne and the 101st. The 101st were paratroops. They'd led the way in Normandy and then Holland. They figured their next action would be the triumphal jump into Berlin.
We were told by PA systems, you know, broadcasting, you would hear it. They'd come down the street and say, all airborne, and that meant everybody airborne, not only 101st, but anybody else. And it was to get back to your outfit, no questions asked, right now. And if you didn't, within so many hours, they'd pick you up and escort you back. And they told us that get everything ready to go, and we didn't know whether we were going to jump or what was going to go on. It was sort of a hang situation. So we just, when we got back to camp, then we found out. And, of course, we didn't really know until we got in the trucks and they said, you're headed for Bastogne. Well, where's Bastogne? You know, we weren't even sure where it was.
The main fight now was for 22-foot strips of pavement, the major roads, most of which ran through two towns, Saint-Vite in the north and Bastogne in the south. A quarter of a million Germans, plus tanks, jeeps, horses, and trucks, squeezed through the Ardennes. Generals stood on their staff cars for hours, directing traffic. While the remains of the American front retreated, the Wehrmacht moved on to Saint-Vite and Bastogne at a crawl.
Well, we were told to move out and move into Bastogne. I mean, we were spread out on each side of the road right into a battle formation. All along the road, you would see dead guys, you know. You could hear the guns going off. You could hear the Germans firing. You could hear a little bit of small arms. And it sounded like it was, oh, maybe 2 or 3 miles away or kilometers away.
The scene at 18th Corps headquarters in Bastogne was one of semi-organized confusion. The Germans were at the gates, almost literally, and that the Corps headquarters was bugging out. We're moving to another location because they didn't want to be overrun.
I saw people coming back. They had a look of, well, I've been beaten, but I don't want to be. And a confused, glassy-eyed look. I mean, they were sort of dazed-like. And you'd ask them a question, what's happening? And they really couldn't tell us. They really couldn't tell us because they didn't know. It happened so fast. And some of them were just plain scared. I mean, they were just... They'd had it. I mean, they didn't know what to do. I remember one young guy kind of jogging along and slogging along. He'd no weapons or anything, and he was actually crying.
The 101st dug itself into the fields and forests around Bastogne. Its job was to hold the town. To the far north, SS tankers had broken through. They were searching frantically for gas reserves. Americans kept a fragile grip on Saint-Vite, but in the soft middle, the Germans had split the line wide open. First day of snow, Bastogne was surrounded. Heavy clouds grounded the American bombers. C-47s loaded with supplies sat on runways, unable to reach the town.
We want what you call well repaired to go into a winter situation. I mean, we had a supply of normal combat fatigue type things, but that's about all we had. Gloves and things like that we didn't have. Footwear was mainly what we needed. We had combat boots that had the buckles on the side. We had those, and we needed something to cover them because we had worn those through Normandy and Holland, a lot of them, and they were worn pretty thin, see? Some of us had even cut holes in them for air where we'd impregnated those things with that gook we used to put on them to waterproof them, see? And your feet would sweat in those things, so we'd cut holes in those. Well, that was a stupid thing to do going into Bastogne because the snow would get in there and like that. We had limited ammunition, and that was one of the things, too, that we lacked was ammunition. We just didn't have time to get supplied full ammo.
Bastogne needed relief. General Patton's army was 100 miles to the south. George S. Patton had a sense of history and the will to make himself a place in it. He was already preparing his main chance, an attack that could propel him into Berlin. When he got wind of the German breakthrough, he feared Ike and Bradley were going to steal away his troops to plug holes in the Ardennes. But it didn't take him long to recognize an opportunity for glory. He told Ike he could pivot most of his attack force within 48 hours and sent word to Bastogne his army was on its way.
On the 22nd of December, when we were totally surrounded, some German officers under a white flag of truce came into our glider regiment with a paper demanding our surrender and telling us all the bad things that would happen if we didn't. Then we went in to General McAuliffe, who was taking a little much-needed nap at that point, and General McAuliffe mistakenly thought that this was some Germans who wanted to surrender to us. But we disabused him of that thought very quickly and said, no, they want us to surrender. And Tony McAuliffe then said, us surrender? Oh, nuts. And then he went on and he said, well, I wonder if we ought to answer them. And we all felt that it required an answer. And I spoke up and said, well, what you first said would be hard to beat. And Tony said, what do you mean? And I said, you said nuts. So he took a pencil and wrote to the German commander, nuts, exclamation point, A.C. McAuliffe commanding. When the surrender ultimatum was learned of, it was apparently a good morale booster for the American public. The American press every day was showing a picture of the Bulge with only Bastogne in the white, and all the rest of it was German, and we were still holding out, and that was about the only good news there was.
Hitler made it plain to his commanders, Bastogne must be taken. He released every spare man to the cause. German artillery flattened the town. Tanks and infantry attacked from every side. There was no way to evacuate the American wounded. Medical supplies were used up. Doctors operated behind makeshift curtains. For anesthetic, they use cognac. This growing drama was not lost on Patton. He radioed ahead. He would crack through on Christmas Day.
Patton was a rather mercurial kind of a guy. Very flashy. They used to say that he was the best ass kicker in the United States Army.
From his command post in Luxembourg City, Patton ordered his men to attack night and day. His army neared the southern flank of the Bulge at a gallop. But 2 days before Christmas, the weather upstaged him.
The weather cleared. And the planes could start flying again. Planes were coming over by the hundreds. You'd see 36 in a group, 36 more, 36 more. And I don't know how many hundreds. And we just look up at the sky and say, thank goodness they're flying again.
And see those guys diving down and strafing. We knew they were hitting tanks. And that's what's keeping the crowds moving and keeping them busy. And this happened from daylight to dark.
Hitler had gambled everything in the Ardennes. His best troops, his new reserves, hundreds of new tanks, and his meager supply of fuel. But he'd always known that wasn't enough. He'd also counted on bad weather. And after 7 days, his luck had run out.
The German offensive stalled out. The Allies held the northern shoulder. In the south, the southern shoulder was held. The Germans were constricted to that 80-mile base. And driving toward Antwerp, they got no farther than just within sight of the Meuse River. Net effect was it died right there. That was the end of it.
Thank you. tomorrow, go stateside with Discovery as we indulge in some chrome dreams with Boys Toys at 10. Then at 11, the American dream turns to a nightmare as Discovery goes on the streets.
You just don't have an awful lot of problem with our product, and it's a lifetime investment.
The State of America.
He's resourcefully regrouped his forces, giving Field Marshal Montgomery complete command over the entire northern sector. With Britain's famous Monty cleverly holding Rundstedt back in the north, his American counterpart, General Bradley, blocks the Nazis in the south.
The first order of business, once the Germans had been stopped, was closing the hole in the American line where the 1st and 3rd armies were wedged apart. Eisenhower's plan was to join the two armies quickly and then push east. Patton wanted to make a bolder move, but Eisenhower held him back.
Patton wanted desperately to drive right back up the original line and be met by a counterattack from the north and thus bag all of the Germans who'd gotten themselves forward in the bulge, so-called bulge. He wanted to cut them off and bag this lot. I still don't understand exactly why the decision was made, but rather than trying to cut these people off in a bag, the decision was made to push them out. So in effect, reserves were committed from the south, from the north, and from here, and the American army simply stood up and slugged its way back toward the start line. Slow, dogged, costly advance.
The enemy and the weather could kill you. If you were hit, you could go into shock, and in that temperature, you could freeze to death before they could get to you.
The first time I dug in, and I was digging my foxhole, and I threw my first shovel full of snow over, and I hit something, and I cleared the snow, and there laid a dead American soldier, froze, see? I mean, you say that could have been me, and I'm here now. We're here. This is the real thing.
The Americans attacked into the worst European winter in memory. But Eisenhower maintained his good cheer. He was a man who lived by numbers, and he knew those were on his side. In the European theater, the Allies held a 10-to-1 advantage in tanks, 3-to-1 in aircraft, 2.5-to-1 in troops. Ike poured 500,000 men into the Ardennes. The Battle of the Bulge would become the biggest, costliest battle in U.S. history. For many young Americans, their introduction to the raw experience of war.
Our first attack, major offensive, was on January the 7th. We moved up under artillery fire to an attack position, and we were hit from behind. And actually, it was our own companies in our battalion had gotten a little bit offline. And in the confusion of that was going on at that time, they mistook us for the Germans and started firing at us from the rear. After that was straightened out, then we began our attack on the woods. And then we came to a large open field. On the other side of the field was a large tank. Giving devastating fire into our ranks, and I think the Army turns it strategic withdrawal. But it really, we really just beat it out of there, and I was seeing people ahead of me falling and being hit, and so I went to down on my face, and I looked at right in front of me, there was a friend of mine that had I could see had been killed. We probably had in the neighborhood of 200 people in the company. And at the end of that day, I understand about 64 were present. It was a real turning point in our life because I don't think any of us have ever been the same after that day.
About midnight, I was sleeping. My buddy was on duty. And somehow or other, the Germans got within 20 yards of our position. Gordon got ripped by a machine gun from roughly the left thigh through the right waist. He then told me that he was hit through the stomach as well. Well, when you're that far from your home base and it's snowing and the temperature's zero, you don't have a chance. We were cut off. The Germans had overrun our position and we were in the foxhole by ourselves. So basically, we both knew he was going to die. We had no morphine. We couldn't ease it. And so I tried to knock him out. He took off his helmet, held his jaw up, and just whacked it as hard as I could because he wanted to be put out. That didn't work. And so I hit him over the head with a helmet. And that didn't work. Nothing worked. He slowly froze to death, bled to death. The next morning, as we looked at our gear, it looked as if I'd spent a day in a butcher shop. My clothes were all covered with blood. His clothes were all covered with blood. The territory we were in was all covered. It was a butcher shop.
The hardest part of the fighting for the 101st was not during the time that we were on the defensive, even though we were surrounded. The most difficult fighting that we really had was when we were asked to go on the offensive. By this time, the Germans were on the defense, and they were trying their best to keep an opening so they could get their people out of the bulge and back to Germany.
The German generals knew their army was overextended and badly exposed. They wanted to pull their men quickly across the Rhine to the safety of the homeland. Hitler refused. On January 8th, he reluctantly allowed his men to inch back, but there would be no easy retreat. They were to fight as they went. The German army had fought through Russian winters. Its commanders understood winter warfare. They set up defensive positions on the high ground and in the warmth of the towns. The Americans lived out in the woods.
Most of the time we were in foxhole by ourselves. Occasionally we'd be with some, and we were foxholes probably scattered out anywhere from 30 to 50 yards apart. You had very little contact with anybody. They just shelled us continuously. If you got out of your hole, you'd liable to get blown away.
It's a screaming sound to the 88s, which was a major artillery on the part of the Germans. And the first is absolutely frightening. It's a nightmare. Eventually you get accustomed to it, you begin to make judgments about it. Is it coming in close? Is it going to go far or what? And you begin to be able to estimate pretty much where it's going to hit.
You can't fight back. Most people just kind of double up like that and hunker down, as they say, and hope that somebody else, not you, gets it.
The Americans were now on the attack. Each day, the men had to come out of their holes and advance into artillery fire. The Germans had superior guns, and still plenty of them. Artillery accounted for half of all American casualties in the Bulge.
You had people killed in many different ways. And you would see hands around, arms, bodies. You'd see a whole body there, horribly chopped up.
people didn't crumple and fall like it did in the Hollywood movies. They were tossed in the air. They were whipped around. They was hit to the ground hard, and their blood splattered everywhere. And a lot of people were standing close to people and found themselves covered in blood and flesh of their friends. And, and that's a pretty tough thing for anybody to handle, and we were no exception to that.
We had a staff meeting every morning on the operational situation, the intelligence situation, and always a manpower report on the casualties from the day before.
As the GIs crept forward in the Ardennes, their generals sifted reports from the front.